This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 12, 2007. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Aura Bogado. Senators take up an energy bill that attempts to reduce the nation's dependence on fossil fuels. Factional fighting escalates in the Palestinian territories with more than 24 people killed in the past 2 days. And the nation marks 40 years since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a ban on interracial marriages.
They get arrested in the middle of the night. Three guys in your bedroom, flashlights in your faces, gruff voices demanding to know who you are and what right you have to be lying in bed together.
All this and more to come, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan have killed 7 Afghan policemen in what is one of the deadliest incidents of friendly fire since the start of the war. The press officer for Afghan President Hamid Karzai said the police were not aware that U.S. forces were to conduct a nighttime operation in the area and therefore opened fire as they approached a checkpoint, fearing the troops were Taliban fighters. This prompted return fire from the U.S. ground forces and rocket fire from an attack helicopter called to the scene. 4 other policemen were injured in the incident. Meanwhile, U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns has accused Iran of giving aid to Taliban fighters. Speaking today in Paris, Burns also said that Tehran is funneling money to armed groups in Lebanon, Iraq, and the Palestinian territories. The U.S. envoy warned that Iran could face tougher sanctions in the coming weeks if Tehran refuses to agree to come to the negotiating table over its nuclear program. Tony Blair has used one of his last speeches as British Prime Minister to attack the media. He blamed reporters for undermining the country's confidence and self-belief. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
While Tony Blair acknowledges in today's speech that his own government was too involved in political spin, he accuses the media of blurring analysis and comment with what he calls fact.
The fear of missing out means that today's media, more than ever before, hunts in a pack. In these modes, it's like a feral beast, just tearing people and reputations to bits. The damage saps the country's confidence and self-belief. It undermines its assessment of itself, its institutions, and above all, it reduces our capacity to take the right decisions in the right spirit for our future.
Blair criticised what he sees as the lack of balance in the British media and singled out the left-leaning Independent as a views paper, not a newspaper. The editor of the Independent said he considered the attack as a badge of honour, but stressed that the majority of the British press, and the most powerful, are in fact to the right politically. The Prime Minister ended his speech with a call for a review of regulatory framework to make the media more accountable. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia today sentenced a former leader of Croatian Serb rebels to 35 years in prison for war crimes and crimes against humanity. From 1991 to 1994, Milan Martic acted as the self-proclaimed ruler of a breakaway republic within Croatia. The court found that Martic colluded with former Serbian president Slobodan Milosevic to create an area of ethnic Serbian hegemony in the former Yugoslavia. In other news, new evidence in the case of a woman on Texas death row has led an appeals court to halt her execution, which was scheduled for Wednesday. From Houston, FSRN's Renee Feltz reports.
In her original trial, Kathy Henderson was portrayed as a woman who flew into a murderous rage while babysitting Brandon Bowe. A medical examiner testified the 3-month-old boy died from a deliberate, powerful force. Henderson claimed she accidentally dropped the child when she slipped on a toy and his head hit a concrete floor. Now, new research presented to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals supports Henderson's innocence claim. It's based on new science, biomechanical analysis of infant head trauma that shows Brandon's head injuries could have been caused by an accidental short-distance fall. The original medical examiner who testified against Henderson presented a new affidavit to the court that says he can no longer determine the degree of force needed to cause the child's death. In an opinion issued Monday, the court ruled no juror would have found Henderson guilty of capital murder beyond a reasonable doubt if shown the new evidence. Henderson, who is set to die tomorrow, may receive a new trial. While she received a stay, her death sentence remains in place. From Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
House Democrats today introduced legislation to address wage discrimination. The bill stems from the Supreme Court case known as Ledbetter versus Goodyear, in which a female employee sued the tire manufacturer over gender-based wage disparities. The Supreme Court ruled against Ledbetter, citing Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which stipulates a 180-day time limit for the filing of a complaint. The legislation introduced today allows for the 180 days to begin once the employee discovers there is a wage disparity, instead of the time limit beginning with date of hire. And finally, a new study has found that U.S. war veterans are twice as likely to commit suicide as their civilian counterparts. Male soldiers who have been physically disabled or who have suffered psychological trauma are in the highest risk category. The study does not include data from combat veterans returning from Afghanistan or Iraq, but the authors say their findings indicate a greater need for mental health care services from the Veterans Administration system. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh today called for an end to fighting in Gaza between the armed wing of his Hamas movement and that of the rival Fatah movement. At least 27 Palestinians have died over the last 2 days in an escalation in factional fighting. Haniyeh urged the leaders of the armed movements to resume negotiations, 1 day after they announced a truce that lasted only a few hours. Meanwhile, President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah issued a statement today that he believes elements within the Hamas movement are planning a coup against his office. Ghassan Banoura reports.
Abbas's statement came after Hamas fighters attacked two compounds belonging to forces loyal to the Palestinian president in the Gaza Strip. The clashes began 3 days ago, and some are calling the conflict a civil war. Clashes and kidnappings between Hamas and Fatah loyalists are being reported throughout the Gaza Strip. And in the central West Bank city of Ramallah, several incidents of Hamas-Fatah infighting were reported in the city on Tuesday. Several shells hit the house of Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh. While the house was damaged, no injuries were reported. President Abbas has called for a ceasefire on Tuesday evening, but after the almost immediate collapse of Monday's Egyptian brokered truce, there seems little prospect of success. Mohammed Al-Hurani, Fatah Revolutionary Council member in the West Bank, says that a genuine tension to preserve the ceasefire is required.
The real intention should be easy, to control these small groups and preserve this agreement. However, the problem is that some known leaders in Hamas want to solve what they think is a problem with Fatah through the use of force.
Yahya Musa, vice president of the Hamas parliamentary bloc in Gaza, says that Fatah must control its members if peace agreements are to be maintained.
First, there is no political or organizational power in Fatah with which it can control its members. Second, there is an American Zionist agenda that is being implemented by a group of traitors, and that explains what is happening. What is happening is not a struggle between Hamas and Fatah. It is a struggle between all Palestinians and those traitors.
Political analysts like Talal Okal says that any agreement must deal with the core issues in order to end the internal Palestinian conflict.
The core issues are two related facts. One is that Hamas and Fatah have two different political programs. And the second, the power struggle between these two rival parties started when Hamas was not part of the Palestinian Authority, and it moved into the Palestinian Authority when it became the authority.
Israeli security officials reported earlier this week that Fatah has asked for permission from Israel to import weapons to shore up their forces against Hamas. Mohammed Al-Hurani of Fatah said that those weapons were ordered a long time ago for the Palestinian Authority security forces and have nothing to do with the current power-Palestinian conflict. A number of Palestinian voices have called for a ceasefire. Tuesday afternoon, Palestinians in Ramallah city in the West Bank took to the streets in an unorganized protest demanding that Hamas and Fatah stop their power struggle and save the blood of Palestinians. For FSRN and IMEMC.org in occupied Bethlehem, Palestine, this is Ghassan Banoura.
An attempt by Senate Democrats to bring to a vote a resolution expressing no confidence in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez failed yesterday. 53 senators, mostly Democrats, and 7 Republicans voted in favor of the largely symbolic measure. This came amid criticism of Gonzalez over his role in the firing last year of federal prosecutors. Independent Senator Joe Lieberman, a former Democrat who often votes with that party, voted against the no confidence vote. The resolution needed 60 aye votes in order to go forward. Meanwhile, President Bush has returned from a trip to Europe to face a defeat in the Senate of the immigration policy overhaul he supported. Today, he made a rare visit to Capitol Hill, where he met over lunch with Senate Republicans in an effort to convince members of his party to change their position and support the bill. Vice President Dick Cheney and White House advisor Karl Rove joined Bush. The bill is the object of criticism from all points on the political spectrum. It would provide citizenship to millions of undocumented immigrants after a lengthy process and establish a controversial temporary worker program. And it would change criteria for entry into the United States from a system based on family ties to one emphasizing education and job skill levels and English proficiency. But attempts by Senate Republicans to add measures to the bill in advance of a floor vote last week frustrated Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who pulled the bill before it could go to the floor. Now the bipartisan group of senators who authored the bill is trying to find a way to get their colleagues to take it up again. And President Bush supports the effort.
Now's the time to get it done. It's going to take a lot of hard work, a lot of effort. We've got to convince the American people that this bill is the best way to enforce our borders.
President Bush spoke after his lunch with Republican senators today. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama said the meeting was a good one.
I think that being the case, if there's any prospect of something being able to come together that could work, that's probably enhanced. I don't know that any chance that they could just bring up something in a few days by having a few amendments like has been bandied about, I don't think that's would be smart.
Majority Leader Reid has said he will bring up the immigration measure again if Democrats can be assured of more Republican backing. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Stay tuned. The Senate this week is taking up energy legislation after weeks of committee hearings on climate change, energy independence, and skyrocketing oil prices. The bill would launch an energy policy that incorporates more energy production from so-called renewable sources and less use of fossil fuels. Republicans say the bill does little to expand energy sources or reduce gas prices, something they plan to bring up during debate on the bill. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Washington.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is praising the energy bill as bipartisan, combining the work of 4 different committees, Commerce, Energy, Environment, and Foreign Relations.
Those matters that the chairman wanted out of those committees that were not bipartisan are not part of this bill. This is truly a bipartisan bill.
But Republicans are singing a different song. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Unfortunately, doesn't do anything, at least the bill that was called up. Doesn't do anything to address expanded production domestically. And number 2, won't do a single solitary thing to lower gas prices.
Democrats say that in the long run, gas prices from oil won't matter as much because of a new focus on alternative fuels. Senator Ken Salazar, Democrat of Colorado.
The extraordinary progress the Senate has made in the last 5 months responds to a seismic shift in how Americans are thinking about energy and about our world.
This bill sets goals to reduce gasoline consumption by 20% by 2017. They do that by using not only corn-based ethanol, but other types of biofuels as well. It expands alternative fuels to include cellulosic fuels, deriving from plants, sugar, or wood chips, for example. Another focus by Senator Jeff Bingaman, chair of the Energy Committee, would set forth an increase in renewable electricity standards. States must produce 15% of their energy from renewable sources such as wind, solar, or geothermal. But fundamental differences on energy ideology have not subsided. Republicans and some Democrats don't want to diminish the use of coal, nuclear energy, and oil, if it can all be done domestically. Some GOP are drafting measures that expand oil drilling in the outer continental shelf of the U.S. Senator Larry Craig, Republican of Idaho.
But here in the Eastern Gulf are phenomenal resources. Billions and billions of barrels of oil that are very accessible, achievable in a sound environmental way, and we're still saying no.
In last year's energy bill, outer continental shelf drilling was expanded, but states could opt out. One Republican proposal would allow states to start drilling, receiving some of the profit. Republicans are also crafting an alternative to the renewable energy portion of the bill. Senator Pete Domenici, ranking member of the Energy Committee, would call it clean energy standards. It would allow the use of any energy source beyond renewable as long as they meet clean standards. Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, talks about the clean energy he would prefer to see in his state.
There is, in this case, a better choice, fortunately, and that choice is for clean, reasonably priced energy in the Tennessee Valley from conservation and efficiency, from nuclear reactors, a new one of which just opened within the last few weeks in our region by TVA, and by clean coal.
Senator Bingaman, who's the lead author, is also a proponent of nuclear energy, but he says this bill's for renewables only. Electric companies and utilities that have invested in renewable energy support this bill. Those who have not oppose it. The coal lobby is also a big obstacle, as several Democrats come from coal-rich states. And environmentalists say this bill is a good start. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Bush administration is poised to sign the South Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement with the support of Democratic congressional leaders. Meanwhile, workers and activists from the United States and South Korea opposed to the deal gathered in Washington, D.C. yesterday for an event called People's Forum on the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. They say the trade agreement would only benefit transnational corporations and would have a negative impact on employment, health, human rights, and the environment in both countries. If passed, the agreement would become the second largest trade deal since the North American Free Trade Agreement took effect more than 13 years ago. Mia Kim reports from Washington, D.C.
In South Korea, many farmers worry that they could not survive if a Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement passes. Hae-young Lee with the Korea Alliance Against the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement says the chorus, as it is being called, would lead to the collapse of Korean agriculture since it includes all agricultural products except rice.
Most of Korea's 3.5 million farmers are family or small farmers. Korea's agriculture may disappear in 10 years to 15 years. Korea's farmer who cultivate small land simply cannot compete with U.S. agribusiness.
In the U.S., the auto industry is greatly concerned by the potential impact on its sector. Last week, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton announced she would oppose ratification of the free trade agreement with South Korea. Clinton said the agreement would harm the U.S. automotive industry and put American jobs at risk. Doug Meyer with United Auto Workers agrees.
In 2006, Korea exported almost 700,000 vehicles to the United States, while the United States exported fewer than 4,000 vehicles to Korea. As a result, the U.S. Had a $11.5 billion automotive trade deficit with Korea last year.
Meyer says the free trade agreement would increase the trade deficit with Korea. But according to Geun-tae Park with the Korea Metal Workers Union, the scenario described by Meyer isn't the whole story. Geun says the free trade agreement would also hurt auto workers in South Korea.
Even as Korean cars are finding more market share abroad, we saw the decreasing number of the permanent workers employed in the industry. whereas employers are turning more and more to temporary workers. And this brought about the whole feeling of an unstable job base in the industry. This clearly shows that the interests of capitalists and the interests of workers do not go together.
Tom Rodden with Alliance for Responsible Trade says it is important for American people to stop this agreement from passing, and describe the kind of trade model for which his group is advocating.
We want a new trade policy which protects workers' rights, not corporate rights to outsource. We want a new trade policy which protects the environment, not one which reduces environmental standards. We want a trade policy which promotes the rights to medicine and health care for all, not one which only protects the pharmaceutical company's rights to profits. We want a trade policy which gives communities, not agribusiness corporations, the control of our food.
The deal is expected to be signed by the end of June, but it must still be ratified by South Korea's National Assembly and the U.S. Congress. In protest, one South Korean worker set himself on fire and died as a result of his injuries. Others are presently jailed for organizing in opposition to the FTA. Meanwhile, Korean workers and farmers are planning to have a national day of action at the end of June. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mia Kim in Washington, D.C.
Residents of Bucharest are abuzz after the release of a report on Friday that says their country, Romania, is among several countries used by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to transfer, detain, and interrogate people suspected by the U.S. government of involvement in terrorist activities. The Council of Europe report also named Poland and said that several other European countries were suspected of involvement. Elise Hugues reports from Bucharest.
Swiss Senator Dick Marty, chief investigator of the report, draws on interviews with top security officials in Romania, Poland, and the CIA to deduce Europe's role in what he calls a global spiderweb of secret, illegal prisons. Romanian and Polish authorities refuse to confirm the allegations, saying the report contains no actual evidence of the prisons or their knowledge of them. Sergio Medar, the Romanian intelligence chief in the present and former administrations, called the report pure speculation.
We didn't organize, we didn't manage, and we didn't coordinate any activities of the type mentioned in the Marty report.
The report has been discredited in Romanian media for containing factual errors, including the misnaming of the country's first president. Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesman Ilia Bunica says the report fails to prove Romania's complicity with the CIA, as did a parliamentary investigation in 2005.
We consider that report presents no evidence to support this allegation.
In his first report last year, Marty used flight data and eyewitness evidence to show how CIA aircraft used military and domestic airports in Germany, Spain, Turkey, and Azerbaijan to transport prisoners, while other European countries were used for refueling. Besides Romania and Poland, the report states that suspects were taken to Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, Morocco, and Uzbekistan for interrogation, which likely included torture. Though the report underlines that the CIA itself operated the prisons, it alleges that this was enabled with the cooperation of both the Polish and Romanian governments. According to the European Convention on Human Rights, as well as the U.S. Constitution, no prisoner may be held without charge, due process, and a timely trial. The report underlines the serious violations of civil liberties and human rights conducted by all parties, not least the United States. Although the Council of Europe has no authority to punish human rights abuses, the report is seen as the first step to an EU inquiry, which could result in sanctions against offending countries. Diana Hatnianu, director of the Romanian Association for Human Rights, says the allegations in Marty's report are serious, but cautions that they are based on speculation.
Of course, torturing prisoners on Romanian soil would have been a very serious issue, but until now we have never heard of any concrete proof that something like that happened. If they were at any time stationed on Romanian soil, that's also not clear, and I don't think the report clarify that in any way.
Hatnianu's organization appealed to the government for information after Human Rights Watch first reported the existence of secret prisons in Romania, but she says the government has been far from cooperative.
That was one of the main critics that against the Romanian authorities, but they were not transparent at all, providing information in order to see if something happened or not. It's true that maybe there nothing happened. We have to take into consideration that hypothesis also, but at least the attitude should be more more transparent.
Romania and Poland are considered to be ardently pro-American, joining the Coalition of the Willing in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Since the two countries joined NATO in 2004, the U.S. military has set up bases in both countries, bases on which the U.S. exercises sovereign rights. This raises questions of how much power host countries actually have to prevent human rights abuses on their territory. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Elise Hugas in Bucharest.
Today marks the 40th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision overturning a ban on interracial marriages in the United States. Karen Miller has the story.
Laura Law is black and Brandon Millett is white. Last year, they did something that up until 40 years ago would have been illegal in 19 states. They got married.
We got married at St. Mary's Parish, and then we had a reception at,
that's right,
in Washington, D.C. It was a, I would say, a small wedding with about 100 guests, friends and family on both sides, and it was a formal wedding.
On June 12, 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Loving versus the State of Virginia. The ruling outlawed bans on interracial marriage throughout the U.S. Mildred and Richard Loving were an interracial couple from Virginia. They knew it was against the law for mixed-race couples to marry in their state, so they married in Washington, D.C., a place that didn't have the ban. Professor Peter Wallenstein is author of a book on the Loving case called Tell the Court I Love My Wife. Wallenstein says that the Lovings' troubles began when they went back to Virginia to live.
They get arrested in the middle of the night. Three guys in your bedroom, flashlights in your faces, gruff voices demanding to know who you are and what rights you have to be lying in bed together. They were arrested, they were tried, they were convicted, they were sentenced to 1 year in jail. But then in a plea agreement, they were offered the option, how about you leave the state for 25 years and never come back together, and we'll let you go. So they did. They moved to D.C. And they'd come back to Virginia. They'd take a chance, and they'd come back to visit family. But they were always at risk.
The Lovings eventually won their case, and since then, the number of interracial couples in the U.S. has grown. But even today, mixed-race couples still face challenges with how society views them. Millett says that even though he and Laura had family support, there were still some awkward moments.
I remember early on when I first started dating Laura, introducing Laura to a friend of mine, and after Laura had left, he remarked to me that he was surprised, he was shocked that she was African-American. And, you know, I guess the sort of the suggestion was, you should have prepared me somehow. And I thought that that was kind of a strange thing. I never thought about having to tell people before they met Laura that she was a different race. But, you know, that's something that came up kind of early on.
The ACLU brought the Loving case to the Supreme Court. Kent Willis is the current director of the ACLU office in Virginia. He says the message from the Loving case is clear.
What flows from the Loving case is this notion that the right of two people in love to form a bond recognized by the state is something that should be constitutional.
After the Loving case was decided, proponents of same-sex marriages used it as a precedent. Willis said the Loving case reflected the climate of the country.
The Loving case, it came in the midst of the civil rights movement when the entire mood of the country, particularly at the national level, was changing. And so the Loving case rode a tide of cultural change that said we ought to be treating the races equally. The problem for the gay marriage movement right now is the tide is not rising as fast and with the same momentum that the civil rights movement had at the time.
The Loving case was a unanimous Supreme Court vote. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from KPFA in Berkeley. I'm Sandra Lupien.